Please note, this episode contains descriptions of child trafficking, prostitution, labor trafficking, trauma bonding, and molestation. Listener discretion is advised. Welcome to another episode of Trafficked. I'm so thrilled to introduce you to today's guest, Holly Gibbs. Holly is making a profound difference in ending human trafficking. And you really defy all odds, Holly, if you look at what happened to you and who you've become. And I'm honored and thrilled to have you here today. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
So we'll get to later on who you are and what difference you make now, but I think it provides a beautiful context to share your own story. Will you take us back to prior to age 14?
Sure. Well, thanks, Cheryl, for inviting me to the show and for highlighting this particular topic. I think with education, we can help to prevent this from happening to other people, especially kids who are most vulnerable. At age 14, most kids are vulnerable, right? It's just a tough time. So before I even met this person at my local shopping mall, I was struggling as a middle school kid. I was struggling to fit in. I was just so concerned with my friends and what they were doing, and did they still like me, and are they hanging out with other people, and am I ever going to get a real boyfriend, and everyone else is getting a boyfriend. Am I not pretty enough? Am I not cool enough? Am I not tough enough? I just felt like I was not measuring up. And as high school came on the horizon, I really started to panic. I thought that life as I knew it was going to just come crashing down around me once I entered high school, because my best friend was already starting to hang out with other people. And I just wasn't coping with that. I felt like I was being left behind. So I couldn't concentrate in school. I used to, you know, get great grades, but in middle school, I just couldn't concentrate on schoolwork. I was so distracted by everything else. I wasn't getting along with my teachers. I wasn't getting along with my parents. I didn't even want to be home with my family. I wanted to be out there, you know, with the cool crowd. And I just had so much anxiety. If that helps to paint a picture, I also want to point out that something that I highlight in my book is the profound impact that media had on me. So, I was constantly watching movies and MTV, and I was just constantly exposed to images and information that told me that women are supposed to be objectified. Women are supposed to be sexualized. Women are supposed to enjoy sex all the time. It almost felt like I was obligated. So I was already being exploited by older boys in my community who were taking advantage of a kid who, you know, didn't necessarily have the oversight and the guidance that I needed to navigate all these messages. My mom was diagnosed with stage 4 breast cancer when I was 12 or 13. And so she and my father were coping with that and taking my mom to get these breast cancer treatments. And they weren't telling me how terrible the prognosis was because they were trying to protect me. But in doing that, I sort of became more isolated from my family and wound up in situations in the community where I was open to exploitation.
Holly, it's, It's sad. Human to human, you know, looking at who you've become, I would say your life is anything but sad, but I'm saddened by hearing those words. And yet I'm struck by that sounds like everybody's teen years.
Absolutely.
And I don't mean to minimalize in any way, but it's what I think we have to wake people up to recognize is this could happen to anybody.
Right. You know, you've got two forces. You've got everything that that teen boys and girls are hearing out in the world. And then, you know, naturally as teenagers are, we're going to be experiencing difficulties. And traffickers are looking to capitalize on all of those forces.
Yes.
Predators in general, but traffickers, you know, I think they understand that a lot of young girls are already groomed by the world, by the media, to accept exploitation.
I didn't hear the word you said, and then it was like, wow, that says something. Did you say to accept exploitation or expect exploitation?
You know, almost either one, but I would say accept it. That's where I was. I can talk more about those dynamics once I was in the situation that I was in. All of those factors played a role in why I didn't run. You know, why did I do this or why did I not do that? All of those factors before meeting this person played a role in how I reacted during that experience.
I'm sure they did. So share with us the story, if you will. You were at the mall?
Sure. So yeah, I was at my local shopping mall, which is, you know, every teen is going shopping. At least in my teen years, we were at the shopping mall almost every weekend. And this was a bright and busy suburban shopping mall. It wasn't a place that I thought I had to be on the lookout for predators, you know. I'd been going school shopping there with my parents since I was a kid. So I was walking through the mall that day, sort of straggling behind my friends, again, just feeling very isolated or distant from them, just not feeling connected. And I started this habit of looking around me, especially at older guys, but just looking around me, trying to make a connection with someone out there in the world. And I got totally used to people looking right past me. So I was walking and looking. And one day at the mall, this man, he was on the phone, didn't look away when we made eye contact. And he raised his finger and he pointed for me to come over. He gestured for me to come over to him. And so this sort of snapped me back into the moment. And I turned around and looked behind me thinking he must be pointing to somebody else. And nobody was there. So I looked back at him and he did the same thing. And I shook my head no. I was just stunned that somebody was responding to me. And so I kept walking, kept watching him, and he kept watching me. And then I began to feel curious. Like, he, out of all these people, he is trying to talk to me. What does he want? Does he think I'm someone else, or does he want to talk to me? And, you know, my friends who I always felt were cooler, tougher, prettier, and so on, he wasn't trying to connect with them. So naturally, I walked over to him. We exchanged phone numbers, and I was back with my friends very quickly. Like, the exchange was very fast, and I realized today that was probably on purpose, because this man probably didn't want to call attention to the fact that he had just called over a random young girl. So from there, we started talking on the phone. And in the privacy of my bedroom, you know, on my teen line, that felt very safe. And you compare it to today, traffickers, many predators, including traffickers, are targeting kids online. And when you're in your home, in your bedroom, talking to someone on the phone or online, it just feels safe. But for me, you know, I was always talking to my friends, their older brothers. This was just another person who was calling me. But this person was different in that he was only mine. He was only my friend. And, you know, he talked to me very differently than my friends. My friends, none of us took each other seriously. We would make fun of each other. We weren't good friends to each other. My friends weren't people that I could say, hey, this or that is going on and I'm struggling in this way. So he would ask me questions that made me feel like he really cared about what I had to say. He didn't make fun of me. He didn't laugh at me. So we talked on the phone for maybe 2 weeks. And he said things that made me feel good. He said that I was pretty enough to be a model, which I didn't believe, but it felt really good to hear. And he said that I was too mature for high school, which that was my whole goal, to make people think that I was mature, especially older guys. He also painted a picture of living a glamorous lifestyle. He said he traveled across the country in a red Corvette. He went to famous cities, to famous dance clubs where famous people hung out. And that's when he got my attention, really. Like, I don't remember all the things that we talked about, but when he said that he was in the proximity of famous people, I thought, oh my gosh, he's somebody. And he said if I wanted to, you know, skip out on high school, that he could help me get a job in Los Angeles, California. You know, I grew up in a tiny town called Tuckerton, New Jersey. It's in South Jersey. It's in the middle of the Pine Barrens. And I thought this was a real thing that could happen to me. If I could get to Los Angeles, then maybe I could be discovered in some way. He said he could help me become a musician or a model. I wanted to be a songwriter. So I made the decision to run away. You know, I packed a bag with my favorite pair of zipper jeans and my diary, pictures of my best friend. I even took music tapes and I ran away and I was serious. I thought the next time my friend saw me, I would be on MTV. You know, I had run away before, but this time it was serious. Like the other times I had run away, it was out of anger. Maybe I stayed the night at a friend's house, but I always intended to go home. Where else would I go? So I didn't tell anyone where I was going, and then went to a different shopping mall to meet this man. I'll tell you what I didn't realize at the time were a few things. The man that I was talking to on the phone, he told me he was in his early 20s. That wasn't true. He was actually in his 30s. I certainly didn't know that he was a pimp or a trafficker. I don't even know if I knew the term trafficker at that time, but my idea of a pimp was like some sort of a, you know, a gang member or someone with a big hat and a Cadillac. I mean, he just looked like one of my friend's older brothers.
Yeah.
And the third thing that I didn't know was I was actually talking to a completely different person than the man that I met at the mall. So there were two
men
working together.
Got it.
There was the man that I met at the mall, and then I believe it is his cousin who spent the time with me on the phone. So when I met this guy at the mall again, who was the original guy that I met, I could tell immediately that something was different. He wasn't the same as he was on the phone. And my 14-year-old brain thought, oh my gosh, I must have done something wrong. Like, he's being standoffish because of something I've done. I must have run away wrong. Because like when I met up with him at the mall, I was sitting on a bench and I sat there for a long time. And maybe he was mad because I was starting to like attract attention because I was just sitting there. Anyway, that's where my brain went. After spending some time at the mall, he bought me a couple of things. He took me to a motel room near Atlantic City. he gave me the impression that we were going to a dance club that night. So I was excited, but very nervous. He left me with an older woman. And she is the one who dyed my hair, dressed me up, put makeup on my face. And we bonded. If I bonded with anybody, it was with her, because he had changed. But when he came back to the motel room, he said he needed to go over the rules. And he said things that made it clear to me that he was talking about prostitution. So, you know, he gives me a new name, he gives me a new birth date, he tells me to repeat these things back to him. And then he starts saying things like, you can't talk to law enforcement, you have to make this much money an hour, do this, do that. And it's all happening quickly, right? He's standing over me, and as he's talking, he's getting bigger and bigger, and rattling things off to me. And then he punches his fist into his open palm in front of my face and tells me not to talk to law enforcement. So a couple things. That's all the intimidation that I needed, okay? As a 14-year-old kid, one of the reasons I was running away is because I was afraid I was going to get beat up in high school. That's part of the reason I thought my life was going to come crashing down, because this false image that I created in middle school as being a tough kid, somebody was going to beat me up and I was going to lose everything. So I was afraid. I lacked the ability to stand up for myself. So I didn't need to be drugged or beaten up or tied to a bed, which is a lot of the imagery in the media to illustrate child sex trafficking. This man, all he had to do was intimidate me. And another thing is, I did not realize I was a victim of a crime. I didn't realize I was a victim, period. I thought, you know, I gave him my phone number. I chose to talk to him. I chose to run away with him. I could only see the choices that I made. So I thought, I got myself into this situation. It's up to me to get myself out. So I didn't think I need to run out of this motel room and find help. I thought, it's up to me to figure this one out.
Right. More of, this is the logic of a child.
Right.
And so often when people unknowingly, I suppose, giving them the benefit of the doubt, are trying to help. Well, why didn't you leave? Why didn't you, how could you have gone? It's not the logic of an adult.
Right.
With forethought, with experience. There's none of those things. Oh, Holly, carry on, please.
So, yeah, you know, there are children and people in general who are abducted and trafficked, either for labor or sex. But the more common scenario is for a trafficker to target a person who is vulnerable, whether it's a child, whether it's a foreign national, you know, an immigrant here working, whether they're here legally or not. If they're vulnerable, they are more likely to be targeted. People, you know, with addiction issues, prior trauma and abuse, mental health issues, all these people would be considered more vulnerable. And so a trafficker is looking for the least path of resistance, right? They don't want to abduct somebody and cause all this attention. So even though I was, you know, listed as a runaway, my parents did report me as missing. A lot of people saw that I went willingly. So it wasn't there was no Amber Alert issued for me, is what I'm trying to say.
Right. Plus then your hair was cut and colored. It wasn't that you weren't easily identifiable, even if somebody were to be on the lookout.
Right. So from there, I was forced into prostitution for two nights in Atlantic City, New Jersey. So I was trafficked in the glamorous casino hotels and in the seedy motels and streets surrounding those casinos. And in 1992, in Atlantic City, New Jersey, life was very different. You can now walk around those areas and there's an outlet mall, there's restaurants, but in the early 90s, there was nothing there. And you had no reason to be walking around between the casinos. It was not safe. So it wasn't like I could, you know, just reach out to someone around me. I was surrounded by people who were in a similar situation as me, or people looking to purchase me. So it was so normalized. Nobody reached out to help me. You know, that I was managed, if you will, by the woman who was taking care of me. She was the one who took me to get pizza. She was the one who took me even to get a beer at a corner bar at one point. She was the one who was waiting for me outside of these rooms, not my family, not my friends, not law enforcement. So you could say I developed a trauma bond with this person. It was in the middle of the second night that I was arrested by law enforcement. So I did see law enforcement out there a couple of times arresting the girls. And on this particular occasion, they arrested the person who was overseeing me. And so what I did was, and I knew, so the man that I met at the mall, his name was Greg. So I knew that Greg was somewhere around me. He was always somewhere around us. Nikki is the name of the girl who was overseeing me. So Nikki would collect the money. And as we walked around the streets of Atlantic City, Greg would appear and they would exchange, you know, she would hand the money off to him. I didn't know he was coming, like he would just appear. So I knew he was always around us watching. So when Nikki was getting arrested by law enforcement, I just stood on the sidewalk and didn't do anything, didn't say anything. And the law enforcement officer finally saw me, and approached me and asked me for my name and my how old I was. And I gave him the speech that I was supposed to give, the speech that I was coached to give by Greg and Nikki.
Wow.
And so it worked. You know, he sort of threw his arms up at me and walked away. Like he was frustrated with me because I wasn't cooperating. And as he was walking away, I thought, this is actually like going to be my life. Like this is what they told me to do worked. And I knew that they were planning on taking me to New York City the following day. And I was pretty overwhelmed by Atlantic City. The idea of going to New York City was very scary to me. So I called out to the officer. Plus, at this point, Greg had sexually assaulted me in the motel room. He made it clear that I didn't have a choice about whether we did that or not. So I knew that if I stayed, that would continue. So I reached out to the officer and said, what if I was under 18? And what I meant by that was, what are my options? This officer became very angry, turned around, handcuffed me, put me in the police car. And on the drive from Pacific Avenue to the police station, this officer, who was probably frustrated, probably had seen a lot of kids like me, talked to me in the worst way possible for someone in that situation. He called me the worst names that you can think of. You know, he may have been trying to do like a scared straight posture with me, but what it did instead was not only did it shut me down mentally and emotionally, but it reinforced my beliefs that I had gotten myself into this situation, that I was now dirty, damaged goods. I no longer belonged in normal society. So I wanted to get out of that police car and go back to Greg and Nikki. I know that that is very hard for folks to hear, but what I thought, so I fully understood that Greg had tricked me into running away. But once I was doing what they wanted me to do, they praised me for it. They tried to make me feel good about what was happening. Whereas this officer made me feel like I no longer belonged in society. So naturally, I wanted to get back to where I did belong. So I wanted to get away from him and get back to Greg and Nikki. I shut down, wouldn't cooperate with law enforcement. and they treated me like I was the criminal. And that initial interaction with law enforcement painted my like how I responded to everyone who got involved with my case from there forward. Ultimately, they determined I was a victim. They ran my name. I came up as a missing person. And there were ultimately three police agencies involved in my case: where I ran away from, where I was sexually assaulted in the motel room, and then in Atlantic City where I was arrested. And all of these agencies had detectives get involved, and they were all interviewing me in a way that made me, that still confirmed to me, still reinforced to me, that I had gotten myself into this situation. But had that initial encounter with law enforcement been different, then the whole experience could have been different. This is why, as terrible as this experience is, and as long as it took me to overcome, I could talk more about that. This is why I dedicate my life today to educating health professionals, law enforcement officers, and others who are going to come into contact with victims and survivors about this topic and about trauma-informed approaches to care and assistance. Because at least we can bring some good out of that experience and make it different for victims and survivors today. And so
reinforcing the trauma bond between the victim or survivor and the captor, and unwittingly driving you back to them,
right?
For a sense of belonging, as skewed as it is, there's still belonging, which can't be replaced or replicated with anything else. Nothing can approximate that experience of belonging, particularly when that trauma has occurred. Oh, goodness, Holly. So then was that then continued and you were returned home, or what happened then?
You know, when people hear that I was a victim of sex trafficking at age 14, they say, you know, you must have been so traumatized by what happened to you in Atlantic City. And truthfully, I believe I was more traumatized by what happened to me after Atlantic City. So my memories of the days following being recovered by law enforcement are very scattered. So much so that I went out and I collected the police files. I went to the police station where I was when I was 14 and collected those files. And I requested medical files from the hospitals I was in. I was ultimately placed in a mental health facility, and I requested the files from there as well, and tried my best to piece it all together. So like I said, there were three police districts involved. I had to go through an emergency department. I had to be seen by an emergency psychiatrist. I was also assessed by an OBGYN. And so, you know, healthcare professionals played an equally significant role in my recovery, as did law enforcement. So it's important for both professions to have education on human trafficking, both labor and sex trafficking, and education on trauma-informed approaches to patient care and services. You know, it was a struggle. I mean, I won't go through all the process of one agency after another, but it was a very difficult time. My parents did pick me up from the police station that night and took me home, which was not the best place for me to go. What would have been best is if I had gone into a residential program for kids who had just experienced something like I did, or at least an agency that's educated to care for kids and help them understand what just happened to them. Because my parents were just as lost as I was. They were just as traumatized. You know, this was, you know, not what they were expecting, or their worst, you know, the worst, one of the worst scenarios, or outcomes. And so they needed support as well. So when I went home, I was actually, you know, another thing is my parents didn't understand why I wasn't cooperating with law enforcement. So they also thought she must want to be there. Everyone began to think she must have wanted this. There's so much stigma attached to prostitution that even at age 14, many of the professionals who cared for me immediately thought that I had made choices to get to do this. So like when I was, one of the case files that I requested was when the psychiatrist interviewed me. And this person wrote that the presenting problem was that the patient chose to run away and become a prostitute.
Oh, good Lord.
And that was before this person, that was the presenting problem.
Professional. And this, say that again?
That was the presenting problem that this person wrote. So that was their, you know, that's their perspective before even talking to me. So I could sense that as a 14-year-old, I could sense that everybody thought I wanted to be there. I wanted to be doing this. So after several days or week, actually it was at least a month because I had to be hospitalized for at least 3 weeks. I thought, you know, okay, so I want to speak to trauma and reactions to trauma. So when I was arrested by law enforcement and taken to that police station, I was crying. I was shut down, not communicating, just totally withdrawn. I remember sitting on the police bench with my knees up, just, you know, just trying to be as small as possible. Well, fast forward a few weeks when I'm in this mental health facility, I thought, if everyone thinks I'm a prostitute, I'm going to show them a prostitute. And I was loud. I took up a lot of space. I was throwing things, cursing, and openly talking about the sex acts that I had to perform in Atlantic City because my goal was to make everybody around me uncomfortable. I was tired of being uncomfortable. I was tired of feeling shame. So I was projecting all that onto everyone else, and I was definitely, I would have been seen as a difficult patient. And I was openly saying I wanted to go back to Atlantic City. And after I was discharged from the hospital, I went back to Atlantic City on my own, immediately arrested that night. But that shows you just how much trauma, just how much change happened to me with just two nights in Atlantic City. There are boys and girls and adults out there who have been trafficked for years. And they've just got years of trauma. There's so much to unpack there. And as health professionals, as law enforcement officers, as social service providers, we have to be aware of the impact of trauma on patients, on victims and survivors. And we have to be mindful of how the trauma that we're witnessing in others is impacting us. So if you go back to the arresting officer that night in Atlantic City, he probably was impacted by what he was seeing day in and day out on the streets of Atlantic City. And if he had support to unpack that secondary trauma, he could have been a better responder for me.
Right. And you know, you mentioned, Holly, it was this two nights of trauma. And I think of all of the trauma, because it's being to unpack it. It's not just the two nights and then the subsequent, but that feeling of isolation and abandonment and not being, and then finally having this relationship or what passed for one over the phone for those couple of weeks, finally having a vision for your life that you could be somebody and do something, and having that taken away is traumatizing.
Right.
This trauma is a spectrum, but I think we don't recognize how traumatizing all of that was, feeling distant from your family already, being left by your friends already, by being worried about not fitting in and getting beat up already, and having that there front and center in your brain every single day as high school approaches.
Mm-hmm.
That is a traumatized being. And you are so right. There's so much education to be done. Not just globally to make us recognize that the problem exists and that it's not just in far off lands or like the movie Trafficked. It's not just like a Lifetime movie or, you know, those kinds of movies, made for TV movies or some harrowing thing like that, but it's at our most vulnerable. Someone could take advantage of that. Every one of us has felt that. I every person I've ever met has had those moments where there's a chink in our armor. We feel vulnerable. And if that were exploited, there but for the grace of God go I, right? That could be us all. And then to the caregivers and first responders, you make such essential points. So to the work you do today, how did you get into that? How were you listened to?
Sure. So, well, you know, after this experience, you know, I finally, it took many years to cope with what happened. I was not connected with the agencies that I needed to be connected with to help me understand what happened. So what happened was I just stuffed down the feelings and the experience, and I forged forward. My parents had me attend a different school. And so I actually did not return to that high school until 10th grade. So I spent 2 years, you know, away from my community, and then I returned. And I struggled with depression, struggled with substance use, just struggled, you know, but did manage to graduate high school, also went to college, graduated college. And so I began to do well, you know, like academically and professionally, but not socially, because I carried this deep, dark secret from my past. So I struggled in my early adulthood still. And it wasn't until about 2009, I believe, that I saw a documentary about women and girls who were forced into prostitution in India. So it was about women and girls who were born or tricked or lured or somehow forced into prostitution. And they called it sex trafficking. And I thought, oh my gosh, there was one story that was so similar to mine. I thought that's what happened to me, but I can't be a victim of sex trafficking because that doesn't happen in America. So I got online and started to search this topic and found out that it does happen in America and that there are agencies supporting victims and survivors. And I was just blown away by this. I literally thought what happened to me, like I was the only person that happened to. So I started to reach out to these agencies, and it ultimately led me to an organization in Washington, D.C. called Courtney's House. This is an agency that provides victim services to boys and girls who've been prostituted in D.C. and in the surrounding area. And this organization was founded and is still led by a survivor of sex trafficking. Her name is Tina Front. So I talked to Tina on the phone. I drove, at the time I was living in Richmond, Virginia. So I drove from Richmond, Virginia to D.C. to meet her and to attend an event. And that is when life really started to change for me, meeting other survivors. One of the guiding principles of a trauma-informed approach to patient care, to victim assistance, is peer support. So I can't tell you, you know, a survivor of any type of trauma, being connected with survivors of similar trauma can be life-changing. And that's exactly what it was for me. Hearing and seeing other survivors of sex trafficking helped me to finally connect the dots and finally understand that it wasn't my fault, that I didn't choose to do that, that this man manipulated me, he coerced me. I finally saw my vulnerabilities. I just had this explosion of connecting the dots. And so from there, At the time, I was working at a microbiology lab. I had graduated college with a degree in biology. And so I started consulting for agencies like Amber Alert, National Center for Missing and Exploited Children, the Office for Victims of Crime. I started, you know, sharing my story. But when I got on stage to share my story, it was often with images of children handcuffed behind me. And I thought, what I'm seeing around me to raise awareness about this topic is not matching my story. And I can see that the audience is confused by the disconnect as well. So I stopped sharing my story and I started to research the topic, and I got a contract to write a book, to write my book, Walking Prey. So in my book, Walking Prey, I share my story. I share my case files, my medical files, my police files, but I also talk about the definition of human trafficking, the realities of human trafficking. And then once that published, I began to share my story again. But I think that so many survivors coming out and giving their perspective helped to influence how agencies were talking about human trafficking. You know, it influenced the types of images that were used to raise awareness about this topic. We're influencing laws, we're influencing victim services, patient care, and so on. So I think that's where the credibility comes in. All of that work that I put into understanding my story, other story, the crime, it's so important that we empower victims and survivors to learn about themselves and the crime, the law, the definitions, to include them in efforts, because that can truly help someone transform from a survivor to a leader in this space.
I think so often we think from a survivor to a, you know, back to base level, or a survivor to, you know, not no longer surviving, you know, on a great day, maybe the quote surviving to thriving, but to become a leader, I step into that challenge. And what I mean is, for that whole vision, I remember seeing at one point Piers Morgan was doing an interview with somebody who was a survivor, mm-hmm. and she was very young, and she appeared to be re-traumatized by the lights, the camera, and the rapid succession with which she was asking these questions. Well, why did you this? Why did you this? And I could see her going inside of herself and judging herself as harshly as he seemed to be judging her. Mm-hmm. It really seemed like re-trauma. And I thought at the time I hadn't shared my story.
Oh, wow.
I was surviving by never telling anybody. And I had become a coach, not like a certification program or something, but because I had gone to years of personal development programs and felt only okay at these periods when I was there, or I was volunteering as a big sister and volunteering with old age homes. And the moment I was helping, I felt okay, but I left and it just like the voices were screaming in my head and all that self-condemnation. And I had at this point been leading programs for thousands of people for years. And I was no longer this scared teenager. And I thought, as I was watching the show, it's my duty as somebody who has become a leader to share my voice. And it's the fact that I haven't it's inconsistent with who I've become. And so I started doing it ever since. And we talk about unconscious bias. I see that in what you've just said, I have some unconscious bias. Like I've been okay with hoping that survivors would become okay, because so many aren't, but that is again inconsistent with the experience that they've gone through, and leadership is truly possible. And I thank you for waking me up. I'm humbled by you. Thank you.
Oh, thank you. Well, Cheryl, you are leading the way for so many survivors of violence. My gosh, you know, I love what you just shared about the interview that you witnessed. I've witnessed those interviews. I've been in those interviews, and we need more interviewers, media professionals who respect, who understand and respect the impact of trauma and the level of healing a person should be in before they're invited to come in for an interview. Right. So I'm so excited that you are doing podcasts and you're finding other ways to provide,
well,
you know, shine light on stories.
Thank you. And it's, I tell you, it's, you've opened my eyes, and I think, you know, my real intention with this series is to continue to open eyes, but I think it's really amazing when even our eyes can be open to something. And I'm not, you know, pretending like I've got something figured out. It's just, I acknowledge you and applaud you for that.
I'm still learning here too. I've learned so much from survivors of many types of trauma, including that, you know, it all overlaps. Trauma is trauma.
Yes.
And so a survivor of sex trafficking is going to, I learned so much from survivors of domestic violence, survivors of sexual assault and so on.
So you've published this book, and that you thought to include all those files, and that's extraordinary. How helpful. I can't wait to read it. So if you've talked a lot today about the myths and misconceptions that are associated with human trafficking and the importance of education for health professionals and other first responders, and the importance that of a trauma-informed approach when caring for survivors and victims. Is there anything else you'd like to teach us, raise our awareness about today?
You know, my story of surviving trafficking is only one story. So as we learn about this topic, it's important that we hear from survivors with different experiences. So a lot of times when people hear the term human trafficking, they immediately think sex trafficking. And human trafficking is an umbrella term that includes labor trafficking and sex trafficking. And we do need to shine a light on persons who are experiencing labor trafficking. And it happens in many types of industries, you know, from carnivals to restaurant services and nail and hair salons to massage parlors to strip clubs and so on. And sex trafficking is also occurring in many different types of settings, including strip clubs and pornography. A lot of times when people hear sex trafficking, they immediately think pimp or gang controlled sex trafficking, but there are many survivors who are trafficked by their own families. And so there are risk factors, their signs and symptoms, their experiences are different. And we need to honor all of these experiences. I try to highlight as many different scenarios of sex trafficking in my book as possible. I interview many survivors, but I don't talk a lot about labor trafficking. And in my role now with Common Spirit Health, which is a national healthcare system, I'm able to educate physicians and other healthcare professionals about the realities of human trafficking. And a lot of times when I'm in front of an audience, I'm talking to folks who still think that human trafficking is something that either happens only overseas or only happens in near our border. And the reality is that human trafficking has been reported in every US state and in DC, the District of Columbia. So, you know, trafficking can look different among urban communities and suburban communities. And so it just because you're living in, you know, a little tiny town like Tuckerton, New Jersey, doesn't mean that kids in that area or people in that area aren't being targeted or trafficked in that same city. Movement is not required. People can be trafficked without leaving their home or their community. So I'm also able to implement policies and procedures that guide health professionals on how to provide trauma-informed victim assistance to patients. And so we have lots of resources available on our website for other healthcare professionals that are interested in our in seeing examples of our policies and procedures. And I can share that with you.
Please, and we will include all of those links in the episode notes. Holly, you are not just a leader, but you are a shining example of what's possible for all of us. Thank you for the difference you make. Thank you for opening our eyes. And thank you so much for the work that you do.
Thanks, Cheryl. I'm so glad that we're connected.
I am as well. If you or someone you know has been taken for sex trafficking, or you suspect that's happening, call 888-373-7888 or text the word HELP to 233-733. With your help, we can stop human trafficking now. To keep up with all of our latest work, please follow us on Facebook and Instagram at The Trafficked Series. Please be sure to rate, review, share, and subscribe to our podcast. And listen to our next episode with survivor Jerome Elam, who is a familial child trafficking survivor, but is now the CEO for Trafficking in America Task Force Child Sex Trafficking. Jerome is also a heroic Marine Corps veteran and a special advisor to the Utah Attorney General. Be sure to tune in to hear his story. Until then. I am your host, Cheryl Hunter, and we are here to end human trafficking. So remember, if you see something, say something. This is a Conveyor Media production. Host and creator, Cheryl Hunter. Executive producers, Colin Whelan and Rebecca Sermons. Head producer, writer, editor, Celine Beth Calderon. And music by Mickey O'Brien.